When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92%? Because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. The Vins are everywhere, but we're flying high, avoiding our boss, trying to watch Casablanca. It's Terry Gilliam's Brazil, this week on Zach on Film.
Pretty much describes my day, trying to avoid my boss watching Casablanca.
Gilliam did say, I believe,
yes,
that all genres, oh God, what was the exact quote? Something about all genres want to repeat themselves.
Okay.
And he's trying to show that in this film, because it turns into a very noir movie. A la Casablanca, in this piece. I'll find the quote.
And it's very interesting. I haven't heard him say that, but it's interesting that the noir comes up, because it certainly is stylized in the film. But what's interesting about Brazil is that this is the second time I've seen it. Every time I think about this film in my mind, it is high contrast black and white.
Yeah.
Like I always forget that this movie is in color. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but I just always think of this movie as black and white. And
yeah,
it is.
It's very easy to do, because
it is a neutral film.
It is a neutral color film.
It's not very colorful.
That should tell you something about the world that he's created, because I mean, everything is bland in this world, right?
Yeah,
the meals are bland. Mm-hmm. It's like the slop that's plopped down in front of you. Everything is burnout and energy. This and following these rules, and very Orwellian. In the sense of the 1984 and the even the 80s commercial, the Nike was no Apple commercial. No, what is it? Apple
yeah,
commercial.
Yeah, the Apple commercial.
The Apple commercial.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much in that similar vein, because when they are driving away at the end of the movie, or part of the movie where they're driving away, and you look beyond the billboards and you see the landscape all around them, it's beautiful and wonderful. And even when our hero is dreaming, everything is brightly colored and very different from this very oppressed world.
Well, the landscape beyond the billboards is colorful at the very end,
mm-hmm.
but not in the middle when you look past them, because
right.
it's very bleak.
Yeah, when he's driving to the... Yeah,
and desert-like and barren.
Mm-hmm.
I have something on that. But we can get to that later once we... let's lay out the framework of Brazil first.
Okay,
so,
go for it.
Brazil is the story of Sam Lowry, who's mm-hmm. this lonely cog in the machine of what is the giant government entity of... What's the Ministry of Information?
Yeah. Yes.
Which is...
Well, he later joins the Ministry of Information.
No.
He joins Information Retrieval?
Retrieval.
Okay.
Right. He's still part of the Ministry
yeah.
of Information.
Right.
Ministry of Information, by the way, one of the best villain organization names of all time.
Ever.
So he's pretty comfortable where he's at. Doesn't really want to move up. But he has been having these dreams of where he's flying a... like a Da Vinci-like... machine high mm-hmm. above the clouds, and there's this woman who is his love, who he needs to free from this giant samurai man. That's his dream state.
Yep.
Eventually he sees her one day while going into work, because an error has been created. There was a typographical error due to a fly being swatted, and the wrong person was kidnapped, setting off this long course of events of Sam seeing his love and going out of character to get a promotion, to get different jobs. We can try to hunt her down better, and then things really get crazy.
So not just a fly, but a bug. A bug in the system. A bug in the system causes this error.
And then it gets weird.
Yeah, and then
this is the thing that I'll say about this film, and really any Terry Gilliam film, with the exception of Time Bandits, although one could argue that the God realm in Time Bandits is like this too. Terry Gilliam creates some amazing worlds. Yep. I mean, just mind-blowingly detailed worlds. You and I recently saw Zero Theorem, right? Did you watch it?
Oh, yeah. Loved it.
We saw that. We saw the world of the future in 12 Monkeys. Did you watch that yet?
I have, yeah.
So have you watched all the ones that I recommended that you watch in this? Okay.
Yeah.
Because the worlds that he created is just this crazy mishmash of... The only way that I could describe this is futuristic steampunk. Because it's this combination of very futuristic pieces with old typewriters, old magnifying glass that you put in front of your old CRTs from back in the day.
It takes place in the far-flung future world of 1939.
It's
where everything is 20 minutes from now, but also like...
Well, but even in Zero Theorem, the world is just very... bizarre yet familiar, and I love that aesthetic. Now, I'm sure it's not Terry Gilliam coming up with this because he works with big teams of people. I'm sure he has input because, I mean, if you look at...
He does the art direction
look at the animations that he did with Monty Python, it kind of has that similar vibe
it,
too.
I mean, I'm sure that his team has some input in it, but
right.
Terry Gilliam is a guy who has a very clear and strong vision, and you can really see it from one film to another. Some creators you'll watch like a Darren Aronofsky film, mm-hmm. like you'll watch it and it's like, this feels like an Aronofsky joint, but the iconography isn't necessarily similar. Mm-hmm. There's something about Terry Gilliam that's like, I don't know, chunky, that's like like bulky and gray, even when it's, you know, bright and shiny and colorful.
Yeah. Terry Gilliam's work is like a 70s British car. Even though it has fins, it's still got that weird kind of blocky sort of functionality to it that's really kind of frightening in a way.
So anyway, go. Sorry, Zach. Go ahead with where you were taking us.
Oh, no. I mean, at that point, the film really gets to a point where the only way we can describe it is to really just start talking about... I mean, the craziness of, like, the meaning of the film, what is happening with Lowry inside of his mind, what is he trying to represent through all the different aspects of the film? Because it really just goes off the rails, and I could spend, like, 30 minutes trying to explain
so
what the movie is.
For me, every time I watch this film, it's all about how crazy bureaucracy has become, mm-hmm. in that before we can look at this, it has to get a stamp from... this other place, but before you can get a stamp, you have to have this form filled out, but they're not going to give you that form if you don't have the stamp on the paper. And it, just the bureau. In fact, when Tuttle, Robert De Niro's character, eventually dies, he's literally killed by the paperwork of the mm-hmm. system. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's what it's always been. I discuss.
For me, there's obviously this, overarching hand of the government throughout this film, mainly through the ducks that are invading everyone's lives.
Mm-hmm.
You can't touch them. Don't do anything with them. Don't decorate them for Christmas. They're just there, and you just have to deal with it. There's no place you're getting away from this Ministry of Information. So there's certainly that aspect, and it's very large. To me, a large part of what I took away from this film was me reading into Gilliam's ideas on consumerism.
Yeah,
which might have been stirred up from, I don't know if we
Zero Theorem.
I think we talked about it off air.
Yeah.
Of there's certainly some ideas of consumerism in Gilliam's recent film Zero Theorem, I think there's some more things he says about religion in that, too.
But see, that's what I thought, too. To me, I looked at Brazil, and that's a an attack on government bureaucracy and the insanity of that. You look at Zero Theorem, and it's basically, you know, an attack on religion. But Gilliam's like, no, this is about consumerism and commercialism. Yeah. And, you know, he goes on to say that that's what Brazil's about, too, is about this love affair with technology and consumer technology.
Yeah. So I think that stuck with me while going to watch this, because I picked up on a lot of consumeristic ideas. I mean, there at one point he's walking through the mall, mm-hmm. and there is like an altar boy, as you see at a like a Catholic church, but on his banner he's walking down the aisle with, it says Consumers for Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of consumerism things, like we mentioned, just buying on the billboards.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole plastic surgery subplot.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And the whole gift exchange. I mean, it's Christmas. This is a Christmas movie. Hey. Yeah. But the constant, just stupid little gifts, this mm-hmm. little yes-no pendulum thing.
Right.
It's just inane nothingness, but people want it.
The gifts thing really stuck out to me, this one, because no one ever even opens the gift, mm-hmm. especially because Sam receives a couple of them, but he never really opens them. He looks at the tag for a few, but it's so crazy, that idea of he walks into his old friend Jack's office, probably about the midway point of the film, mm-hmm. where he's been promoted to information retrieval, and he finds out Jack... also works for this. Mm-hmm. He knew this. But what he does is the retrieving of information from humans through torture.
Right.
And so he's taken off his bloody lab coat, and then he just reaches over at his desk and just grabs a random present. Like, oh, here you go. Right. And he's just so
the meaningless, perfunctory gift.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, a recurring thing in this world, too, is so much of what people do and so much of what people say really doesn't have any meaning behind it. They don't actually, you're not actually getting someone a gift to make them happy. You're not actually, you know, trying to make yourself into something you're not. You're not actually trying to find that girl. You're just kind of weird. And I think it all ties back into that expectation that the person is no longer important in the society. It's what they buy, what they do. When he's on trial, they're like, you're ruining your credit rating. This is costing you so much money. Just confess now so you don't ruin your credit rating.
So the idea of that, you know, Terry Gilliam feels that Brazil is about consumerism, but most people take it to be an attack on kind of, you know, like a two-faced government or bureaucracy or all that stuff, is, I think, a very interesting point, and one that you, Zach, as a filmmaker, need to consider. Sometimes... you need to tone things down. I think the reason why everybody gets that from Brazil is because all of those themes are so strong.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there is this oppressive government. There is this crazy bureaucracy. There is this thing where, like, even the smallest thing requires all these signatures. And I feel that if what he wanted was to make this thing about consumerism, then... he put way too much stuff into the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he just spent way too much time on bureaucracy, and that diluted his meaning. So mm-hmm. even though it's awesome, and even though most people agree that it's awesome, mm-hmm. like, it took away from his meaning.
Yeah.
Do you think it's harder... This is going to be a tangent. Do you think it's harder to put out... like your idea for a film, your thesis about a film, as the creator, through the medium of film, than it is through a painting or music or something, because you're dealing with so many different forms of stimuli through visual and audio.
I think we've talked about this before, the fallacy of the intent of the writer or the creator, right? Sure. Where,
well, I mean, it's he's asking from the creator standpoint, mm-hmm. is if you are, because there's 1,000 reasons why people create things, right? Yeah. Some people want to express themselves. Well, the majority of it is self-expression of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. But some people are like, I wanted to, like, in the Major Spoilers podcast, we reviewed a book called Manifest Destiny, and we found all of these, like, hugely troubling kind of, like, racial tension things between Native Americans and white colonists that, reading from the author's intent, were not there at all.
Right.
They just put out this book that was Lewis and Clark Monster Hunters, and all of this other stuff just kind of like popped out of nowhere, or, you know, was just like absorbed in from like general culture. So you can, like, I think what he's getting at is like, what is the best medium to like convey what you're trying to say, or like, is it harder through film?
Yeah, to a point, because I think film can so easily go into propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, yes, it's such a long form. Generally, I mean, generally, if you're doing a feature film, you're talking for a while. So if you're trying to put this idea throughout the film, I mean, I think it can tip heavy-handedly pretty quick.
Film is also a more of a collaborative thing, too. I mean, there are a lot more hands involved in a film who may want to, you know, adjust or work on the message, and there are a lot more people involved than if Zach wants to make a painting or write a story. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that can be a concern as well. There are more people you have to please when you're making a movie.
Well, and there's, I mean, that's actually a great point, because in film there are so many people involved, and you hear that all the time, right? You talk to like the special effects coordinator for this and that, is like, oh yeah, I based this character on my dog. It's like, well, George Lucas didn't tell that guy, base this character on your dog. He did that. So he's added another layer of meaning to the movie just by the fact that this character moves like a dog, right? I mean, it's something that I think for most audiences, they will just like, it'll just go in one eyeball and out the other, if such a thing is possible. But I mean, it does exist.
So I think what you're really talking about here, Zach, is because we're mixing visual, auditory, color, light, space, all of this stuff. A book, if you have not read it, and it's a really good book, is Herbert Zettel's Sight, Sound, and Motion, Applied Media Aesthetics. And what it looks at, is it breaks down these things. It talks about, well, why is lighting important? What does lighting mean? And how do you convey a message through light or through color or through sound? And whether you use diegetic or non-diegetic sound, what do you do when we're talking about framing? And so he goes through this. It's not a very big book. I mean, it's an oversized book, but it's only probably about an inch thick, maybe, maybe 250 pages or something, full of images. I've got a copy somewhere around here. In fact, I probably have a couple of copies. It's been continuously in print since, I want to say, the 70s, because when I was, even before I came to college, my cousins, who are producers, in news and other medium, had recommended it to me, in the early 80s, because they had used that when they were in college. And it is a fantastic book. I think it's up to 7th or 8th edition right now. But it's definitely worth checking out. I don't know if it's available in Kindle edition. Let me look here real quick.
Okay.
Sight, Sound, and Motion.
And, you know, for Brazil, if you want to talk about a movie that has where everything's really tight, like the mise-en-scène, the sound, the cinematography, the light, it's all very tight. And I think it's very tight for two reasons. There's a clear and strong vision that's guiding everything. And everything is a set made out of paper. So, like, everything has to be, like, super tight because it's very clear. Like, when they start pulling the desk on the wall, great image, great visual, so many great things about it. But you can tell that, like, the wall, even though it may be meant to be thin, is actually thinner than it's supposed to be. It feels like a set.
Yeah, it has, like, the rivets as it's a metal wall, but you can totally see him put on the foot, and it's, like, bending it.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
His foot, like, scuffs paint off of the wall.
And there's a lot of little moments in Brazil where you see those seams, you know, probably just because of the time when it was made, and probably because they blew their budget on the giant samurai puppet or costume. But I mean, it's actually like just shot for shot, like a really tight, like always very motivated story.
Yeah. You're probably not going to buy Sight, Sound, and Motion because it's listed as an academic text.
Oh, geez.
So you can buy it for $220 or you can rent it for $57.
Mm.
But it is a fantastic book, and I will find my copy, and I will loan it to you. In fact, I know I have multiple copies, because I bought a copy in the 80s, and then I've had like three or four copies since then.
Oh,
so,
sure.
It's fantastic.
Cool.
And I think it would help address some of the questions you're having, right? Because isn't that what you're talking about? I mean, I think is... You know, as a filmmaker, the way I use my lighting is going to say something. The way I frame my shot is going to say something. Well, and those two could conflict my message.
That crossing the line into heavy-handedness, like, are you saying that maybe it's easier for film?
No, I think it can easily tip into heavy-handedness, easy for film.
Right.
I don't know.
Compared to other mediums, like,
yeah, it's kind of hard.
Yeah, in songs, it's like, okay, I want to get this point across. In a song, you basically have to do it. I mean, you can have a protest song. You can be a Bob Dylan where he's talking about madmen, drummers, and bummers and stuff like
or
that.
Or you could just have a song called War.
Right, exactly.
Good God,
exactly.
Y'all,
so,
what
I mean,
is
actually,
it good
War
for?
Is like a perfect example of a super heavy-handed song. Mm. It just happens to have a funkalicious beat that makes it a great song.
Sure.
But if you want to talk about something being super heavy-handed, War is a great example. So even in songs, you can be subtle and you can be heavy-handed. In movies, you can be subtle or heavy-handed. You know, there's going to be plenty of people that are jamming to song. Like, well, a great example is Fortunate Son, which they play at 4th of July fireworks displays. And basically, it's an anti-establishment, anti-America song.
Mm-hmm.
But because because chunks of it sound good, they just play them. So it's a song where apparently they are too subtle to say, like, I'm not a senator's son. It's just too subtle. They should, like... It's subtle enough that it still gets thrown out as a patriotic song.
Yeah. And so do you think a creator of a film should be worried about an audience taking a meaning from their work that wasn't intended? So Gilliam says he made about consumerism to a certain extent, but clearly there's some very clear government things going on. Same thing with Zero Theorem, where consumer is definitely a part, but I think there's some very nihilistic versus religion tones throughout the film. So do you think a creator should be concerned about people reading maybe too far into their work or deriving a different meaning than they needed, or should they just be okay that people got a meaning from our film?
I think you need to be aware of it.
Yeah,
right?
I would use is resigned.
Yeah,
like a creator should be resigned.
Yeah, because it's
going to
happen.
That people are going to find different meanings in their work.
Yeah,
and like if you're lucky, enough people will see your work to find different meanings.
Yeah,
I've been fortunate. You know, we do that our Dungeons and Dragons podcast,
right?
And I always feel very nice when somebody sends me these like really off the wall readings of what this means or what happens. Like somebody compared like the second season to like the like a Cold War and a Doomsday Clock.
Right.
That was and I was like, I did not intend that in any way. Not even a little bit. Not even at all. But
But then there's other things, little spoiler, where the season's really about family kind of stuff. I picked up on that like than halfway, before the halfway point.
Absolutely.
And there are still people now that are like, really? That's what it's about?
And both things are going to happen. A, people are going to read themes that you didn't intend into it. And B, people are going to miss your themes.
Mm. Yeah.
Even if you just go like, okay, I don't want anybody to miss this theme. I'm going to have characters literally say it out loud every 10 seconds. There's still going to be people who miss them.
As a creator, certainly you have to be aware of, you know, what they call the unfortunate implications, but you can't necessarily let that control your story. And especially in a movie like this, because this movie actually delves into not only kind of the symbolism of certain things, because many of the events we see do not literally happen. Notably, the death of Robert De Niro's character cannot literally have happened the way that it's shown. But there's a big undercurrent of almost absurdism in here, which is expected from someone who, you know, just got out of Monty Python. There are moments in here that you can feel the Python roots in, and you look at them and you're like, oh, this is meant to definitely be absurd and ridiculous. But for the characters, it's straightforward. This is their life. This is their world. This is what they do. So, I mean, you can't even look at that necessarily and say, mm-hmm. what's the audience going to take away from it? Instead, I mean, he took a lot of things in here that are troubling and delivered them in a way that, yeah, you can read a lot of things into it. But as a creator, I don't know that you can – you will kill yourself. You will go insane trying to figure out every wacky thing. That, you know, people believe that The Shining is Stanley Kubrick admitting that he faked the moon landing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is.
Which is a theory I love. Yeah. I love that theory. Like, if you've watched, what is it called? Room 23?
Yeah, 237.
Yeah. Room 237, yeah. It's great. It's just so great because some of the stuff that they read into it's like, look at the carpet and look at the the place where he pauses. And see all the other, and it's like you're looking at it, and it's like, dude, this carpet does totally look like Cape Canaveral. Oh my, Kubrick! But that's the carpet that was there for the hotel.
And
Kubrick could have been like, oh my god, guys, that looks totally like Cape Canaveral. Let's shoot it here. But he probably didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are he actually didn't. But it's just so tasty, you know. It's just like. Let's indulge for a second in this, and it's like amazing all of the parallels and comparisons that you can draw.
Mm.
What else you got, Zach?
Well, if we want to go into a different, meaning for this film, it's not crazy to assume that Sam and Jill are the same person, right? That Jill is Sam's. Like split personality person.
I've never read it as that.
Never. Okay, so we have this.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Now defend it. Show
your work.
Okay.
Defend it.
The first place that I think you can really start delving into this is a split personality. Is they drive off to the thing and the refinery, which was a really weird. Let's just stop right there. That was a really weird part of the film because you have all these like really grand big buildings that they're totally just fake and recreated. Mm-hmm. And then you drive up to like a real refinery and it felt too real to be in a refinery. It was so strange. So they go and pick up the package and they go back to the mall, right? And he thinks she's about ready to pull off some terrorist plot. But they're fighting. And then... she gets pushed off frame. You don't see her, but there's that mirror there, and it's his reflection as his mom's friend is coming up. So there's that.
Well, no.
And mainly, no one really interacts with her at all besides Jack, which is like a weird printout of a scanned face. So it's kind of, you know, okay, sure. But I think the mirror thing is very... interesting.
Sure. And then on top of that, after she gets taken, he's looking for her and he can't find her.
Right.
And then afterwards, she just shows up again.
Mm-hmm.
Like somehow she escaped.
Out of nowhere.
Yep.
She's back.
So I think there's a lot that you can say for that.
And there's certainly, well, and then this kind of dives into like my other question of, when does he actually go to Jack? And so all of this theory of Sam and Jill are the same person.
Mm-hmm.
When does he actually go to Jack and start getting his mind messed with?
Mm-hmm.
Really, I think only works in the American release of the film. I haven't watched the full director's cut.
Because Rob has my 4-disc.
Well, I asked for it for Christmas,
super
so
duper
I hope we get
Criterion.
But I've watched all four of those.
I've read some of the things that are left in Gilliam's version, which I think explain away some of my ideas why they're the same person, which is another one towards the end of the film. Sam and Jill go into his mother's house to stay. He goes and he erases her from the system.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes back and she's long-haired.
Right.
As we see her in his dreams. And essentially what I take is his child's bedroom, locked inside of his bedroom.
Crap. Or his mother's bedroom.
His mother's bedroom. Yeah, so there's a lot of weird suppression of, you know, like Freudian sexual repression that can be seen there. And then again, she just dies. I mean, at that point, it's certainly all in his mind. But apparently in the Gilliam version, at the very end of the film, they tell Sam that they've killed Jill again, which could be like, oh, okay, so maybe they're different people. But
you could also read that, he's done that before.
Sure. Once you kind of get that idea, again, it's like one of those weird Kubrick is the moon landing conspirator. If you watch it, you can kind of start seeing more and more, especially she is like so opposite of him in the way she just runs the world. She's more upfront and abrasive than Sam is. And eventually he kind of takes over this personality. Really after that bombing, kind of he gets more abrasive and he's actually caring about people, which most people in the world don't care when people are being killed by these bombs, by the terrorists, and he actually starts caring and fighting, and that's when he really starts fighting back, because at that point, we realize that the samurai is himself as he fights back against the place. So it was a really weird rabbit hole of thought I went down while watching this movie again, which made me feel like, Brazil is like the heterosexual version of Fight Club.
Interesting.
That's a thought I had. Of
it's
like
not entirely unfounded.
No, I mean he's projecting like this manly man version in Fight Club, and he is like this manly woman version almost.
Like
yeah.
She is a truck driver.
Yeah, that's I can definitely see that. I think there are points where the thesis is shaky, but again, that's the glorious thing about like really weird movies is that you can just do that. My read of it, which I think like I was like I should come up with a different read than the obvious one.
Obvious one?
Well, the obvious one is, you know, he's kind of having these hallucinations, he gets caught at the end, and then you kind of go through this dream sequence, and then you realize that, oh no, he didn't escape, he got caught, right? My second read of it is that he's actually always in the chair, and he is recounting this whole thing in his head as part of the interrogation. And that is why it is frequently intercut with him flying and fighting the samurai, because there's no direct thing. Like sometimes the samurai is a soldier, sometimes he's just like the bureaucracy. And that's why this thing gets intercut. But it's like we never see him like jumping around like a stupid man holding a pipe, pretending like it's a sword. We don't see him from the outside having this hallucination. Most of this movie happens directly at the main character.
And the first scene of the movie is his dream of flying.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, and it's if you look at the version of the film that we watched up on iTunes, first shot of the film is in the clouds as we fade out from the nuclear reactor interrogation room, we go right back into the clouds. So I could very much see your read being a lot closer than the
main issue that I have with this read is that it removes a lot of the fun parts of the movie. For example, the bug, the mistake. I mean, as a clerk, that could have been like a theory that he had, is like, oh, maybe a fly fell into it or something like that. But the fact that the whole movie gets spiraled out of like this simple typographical error is really lost when you think, well, the main if this is the main character going through this interrogation, he wasn't there. That's something that he made up. And granted, this movie was written by a person, so all coincidences are purposeful. But that's a level of suspension of disbelief that usually going into a movie we're more than willing to take. Adding a second layer it, you know, just kind of removes that. And there's a couple other things that it's like, well, like maybe the food wasn't so such slop. Maybe the
air conditioner breaking wasn't such a big deal.
Yeah, maybe the mom's friend. Yeah, maybe those repair guys weren't tied into it at all, and he's just drawing these connections. Maybe the mom's friend, like, she just had a little bit of acid on her face, and it wasn't a big deal, but he just saw her as this thing that was, like, slowly falling apart, right? There's all these things.
which is really funny when you think, because Sam certainly doesn't have the highest opinion of himself, especially when he tells, like, Jill that she's faking that he's so attractive to him. He's, like, so blown away. But one of my favorite funny moments of this is at the Christmas party, and you know the moms are trying to pair their siblings up, or their little children up,
right?
And she says how she's not really attracted to him either. But I think the best facial reaction in the film is when he's leaving to go talk to Jack, and he like stumbles over her, and she has like this,
and she brushes him away.
So good,
yeah. There's another movie that you might want to watch. I don't know if it's tied into either one of your two theories, but at one point Sam does have a very literal psychotic break when he's battling the samurai, and he's flipping back and forth between the quote real world and his fantasy dream. When I watch this, and again, maybe it's just because I don't think I've seen every Terry Gilliam film, because I haven't seen I've seen that one. Tilting at Windmills, good. It's never been released.
Dr. Parnassus?
That's the one I haven't seen.
That's the
Imaginarium
one
of Dr. Parnassus.
Yeah, that's that one.
Yeah, with Heath Ledger, right?
With Heath Ledger.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen that one.
Like Johnny Depp.
I've been wanting to watch that
everyone.
Movie forever.
Yeah. The Fisher King is one of my favorite movies of all time.
What I was getting to is the Fisher King has a sequence in here. There are sequences and parallels between Fisher King and Brazil where the characters are having a psychotic break. For Robin Williams, which, again, if you want to see a brilliant Robin Williams portrayal, watch him go crazy in The Fisher King. But he is being chased by the Black Knight throughout the movie. And just the way that Gilliam portrays the Black Knight compared to the Robin Williams character, and the way that Sam and the Samurai... interact with one another, very similar in how they have their big battle at the end, and both have it's very cathartic for both characters in that scene. But when I was watching this the other day again, I was like, wow, that has a lot of similarities to Fisher King, and now I need to go see Fisher King again because it is really, really good. It's not, you know, you've seen 12 Monkeys this movie and Zero Theorem, but you probably haven't watched any of the other Gilliam movies.
Not besides Holy Grail.
You might really, really, really like Fisher King.
Holy Grail?
Yeah, he did.
I didn't think he directed Holy Grail.
I think he co-directed it. Or no, he did the animation?
Yeah, Terry did animation for Monty Python. I want to say that Graham Chapman directed Holy Grail, but that's neither.
Yeah, I think he has like a co-director credit on it or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing that I really love about this film is, and be ready to gasp, gentlemen, never seen this movie.
What?
I have never seen Brazil. And there are two reasons why. One, I confused it in my head for a long time with The Boys from Brazil that I saw a little bit of.
Oh, no, that's a total different film.
I know. And two, a long time ago, somebody told me that this movie was just basically a badly done 1984. And so that little voice was in the back of my head. And I don't watch movies. But watching this movie today for the first time, literally, I ended it like a half hour before we started recording. I was struck by the fascinating ways that you could extrapolate the parallels of this future world of 1939 to things that are happening in 2014.
There were some very weird things. Yeah.
And it's amazing how, you know, I don't know if it's a question of Terry Gilliam being really good at satire and being kind of prescient about society, or maybe the fears that we have that everything is worse than it's ever been and everything's going down the crapper are the same fears that they had in 85 and the same fears that they had in 57.
But, I mean,
yeah.
Where,
my God, when the floor if the floor drops in that first scene in Mr. Buttle's house, and in come the armored, oh my God, I'm like, holy crap.
Yeah.
A little too close to home.
And we're talking, we are recording this the day where all the CIA pages of all the torture in Guantanamo Bay just released. Yep. And we're talking about Brazil, where people are supposedly empathetic hero character of Sam is just totally blasé about the fact that his friend just tortured a person to death and is just removing it. Like, no one doesn't even like faze him.
It's very, very strange.
There's a point where he discovers that it was his friend who killed Buttle, and it's in the middle of a conversation, and it's just kind of like, oh,
yeah.
Well, we can't do that then. And it just really freaky sequences.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And of course, everybody has a screen, no matter where they go.
Yes.
And it's not like a personal screen, but it squeaks out of everywhere. You know, it was really, really interesting commentary on if you look at, you know, and you try and extrapolate what culture might be like. I feel like Terry did a pretty good job.
Yeah, you should. I think he did a really good job with commentary on social technology in Zero Theorem. If you want to see him play more with that, because even in that movie, it's really interesting. Because the first thing that ever struck me about Brazil, the first time I watched it, was those giant like magnifying lenses over the tiger screen. So those are just crazy, and they're so interesting to look at.
I love that.
Yeah,
just real products though. Back in the day, your TV was very small. You had a 13-inch screen. You want it to be bigger, you put one of these big magnifying glasses in front of it, and you had a bigger screen.
That's crazy. And then in Zero Theorem, a lot of the computer consoles, their screens are more vertical. Like, they're taller than they are wide, which is really strange to look at.
Paper is taller than it is wide.
Oh!
Yeah, but this screen's in Zero Theorem are, like, not even proportional to paper.
What else, Zach?
What else? I think I loved his dolly moves throughout this film. I mean, I think the best one is just information. Oh God, what is Sam in the beginning? Like recording or something where they just document stuff. He's not information retrieval yet. But those dolly moves from like the front all the way to the back, with just people just scurrying around with all their papers and their typewriters, and those are just really great. And there's just a lot of little subtle camera moves throughout the piece. There's certainly some Steadicam shots as they go through some of the halls. Just really good. But the miniature stuff, I would assume there's miniature stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
This is like how they did before a lot of digital effects. Yeah.
How they got some of the sets to look like that is just mind-boggling. Yeah.
Amazing. And what's really interesting is in some of those early sequences, I think he starts in the Department of Records, it feels kind of like a Busby Berkeley musical with everybody moving all together and people. And it's really cool. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's a point really early in the film where we're just seeing someone watching the television and he's talking. That's the British presenter. Then there's this massive explosion right in the middle of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, I did not see that coming at all. And then we cut to that weird musical sequence, and then it gets all – just like this. First of all, Terry knows how to start a movie with that explosion. But second of all of the stuff that is in here should not fit together as seamlessly as it does.
That's why I said the world is so mind-bending in the way it works.
It's thorough, really, is what it is. There's this kind of – there is this central set of themes to it. And they say, okay, so let's extrapolate that to a bunch of pencil pushers. All right, now let's extrapolate that to, like, basically the rock star bureaucrat, like, basically your CIA. What do they behave like? Mm-hmm. And that's when you get him, like, walking into, like, what appears to be an empty hallway, and first seeing them, like, way behind them, like, this mass of people going, and then, like, disappearing into another hallway until they finally catch up to us, right? Mm-hmm. Two departments in the same bureaucracy. Yeah. And just miles apart, like, visually, aesthetically, and yet clearly still a part of this, like, really super crappy, dingy, awful, amazing world.
Yeah, it's I mean, that scene in particular had me going, oh, wait, I worked in something that was very heavy,
yes,
bureaucratic, not as bad as this, but it was, I mean, just to show you how crazy this is, at the place that I worked before, when it came time to hiring an adjunct professor, even though the classes were signed up for, so if we were talking about a winter class, those mm-hmm. classes were already assigned, already scheduled in June of the previous year. February of the year that the courses are being taught, contracts are still going through the system.
Jeez. Holy crap.
Because of all the little dots and periods and things, and if you don't have it exactly right, they kick it back to you, and you either have to start it again, or it gets lost in a shuffle, or this or that happens. And there are times where you're up in the ivory tower of Jack, and you're able to do whatever it is that you want to do without recourse. And there are times when you're on level 30, and you are running back and forth listening to the yes-no man, and you're given limited resources to work with. And then there are times when you're in the bowels of the system, literally working with pipes and tubes, trying to make the bloody thing work.
Yep. And all you can really do is be a cog, is take one thing, take something from someone and give it to someone else.
Yes.
And like that becomes your job.
Yes. And it was infuriating. So I can, a lot of, especially that scene in particular, I was like, oh my God, think, it literally shook me in my seat of, wow, that was, yeah. That is so many businesses that I know.
Oh yeah, that's every call center I've ever worked in. Now, luckily, I have a job that I'm like Harry Tuttle. I swing in on a zip line with my special tool belt, and I fix something, and I swing right the F out.
Yeah, because Matthew was actually fired from that job like about 4 weeks ago, but he still goes, and he still fixes things, even though he's not actually in the system.
They're gonna fix the glitch. But and wasn't it amazing? Again, I never seen this movie. All of a sudden, in the middle of this film, here's frickin' Robert De Niro.
Yeah, Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro, I swear, he is such a... Like, if he's not the main character, I just always find him so weirdly out of place. I don't know if it's like he has a commanding presence or he's just like a giant ham. But, like, I recently saw Stardust, and it is so weird
when
he pops in there in the middle of the movie. And I'm like, it feels like... I mean, it feels like a glitch in the Matrix.
Yeah,
it feels like all of a sudden all of the doors are brick walls when he shows up. It's just so weird.
But I think part of that is Terry Gilliam as the director being able to nab Robin Williams to play. And again, you see Robin Williams playing zany, crazy characters. And before The Fisher King, I think he played maybe one serious character in a PBS drama.
That was before Good Morning Vietnam.
No, it would have been after Good Morning Vietnam.
So that was probably
But Good Morning Vietnam was still over the top, you know, crazy funny.
Sure.
And even though he was being a serious character, most of the time he was being a silly character and ad-libbing. In Fisher King, he is very, I mean, it's very, I mean, his craziness is part of the character. But in order to get Robin Williams or to get Robert De Niro or any of these other actors, I mean, who was in Zero Theorem? Christoph Waltz,
is that Christoph Waltz is the main character.
Yeah.
Matt Damon.
And Matt Damon is in there. I mean, just in order to nab these people, you have to have a reputation of, I want to work with this person.
Well, I'm Bruce Willis in 12 Monkeys.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Especially for a non-Bruce Willis role, almost.
Right, right.
To do that. And to get a good performance out of him in that, too, is surprising.
He does get to, Brad Pitt, I think, break a phone.
Yeah. So what do you take away from all this, Zach?
There's a lot to take away from Brazil. Even though we didn't get into it from, like, the business side. There's a book called The Battle of Brazil you can
That's the one that I had read years ago. Yeah.
That details the fight Gilliam had with studio execs on how the film would be cut, how it would be shown, and some weird tactics he did to make sure people saw the cut he wanted to show free screenings at UC and stuff.
So that story was, they invited him to come and speak on campus to be a guest lecturer or something. And he's like, sure, and I'd also like to bring and show the class the entire film of Brazil, this film that I just finished. And then what the university did, or I don't know if he encouraged the university to do this, but the university leaked out that they were going to premiere, you know, premiere this and show it. And so he walked in, and the room was just packed with people. Mm-hmm. And by that time, the studio had heard about this, said, no, you can't show it.
Right.
And so he's trying to explain to the class. And while the class is going on, he's going back and forth with the studio over what he can show or not show. And finally, they agree to let him show one clip. And he took that as, well, the entire movie's a clip, so here's movie. And then he did that for 2 weeks of every day. And then the local reviewers found out about it, and they went down and watched it. And that's how he won the, was it the LA Film Critic Award or something, just based on showing it down at UCLA or wherever, USC.
And I think for a version that wasn't the theatrical version, too, wasn't it?
And there are so many different versions of this film floating around. If you do get the Criterion Collection, it does include all of the various cuts, including the Terry Gilliam final cut.
Yeah.
In that collection, there's the TV broadcast cut, there's the theatrical cut, there's the studio release,
and and they are all like the studio, the TV cut is like 90 minutes and everything is chopped up. There's like a narration sequence in the beginning. It's nuts to hear about how much they grew over this movie. It's crazy. But I think our big conversation about creator message, I think, was something really good that we touched on. I can really take away from Brazil, because it's really one of those movies that just makes you think and like forces you to like address certain things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's possible to just watch Brazil from a purely escapism point of view all the way through. I mean, certainly I think you could watch certain scenes, and but I think Brazil is a film that kind of forces you to think about certain things. But I think which is a good, a good quality. I think some film directors have that, where they can do a big blockbuster movie and still make you think.
The power of surrealism is that when you show something that's realistic, you're telling people, this is an apple, you're looking at a table, all this stuff. When you make something surreal, you force people to meet you, like to come to you as a as a creator. And that movement, that leap, is completely full of their biases, their ideas, their opinions. So that's why Brazil makes you think, is because in your trying to understand the movie, you have to fill in all the gaps with your own personal experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Brazil is awesome. Anything else?
Aubrey, watch it.
Aubrey, let's see. She had a migraine when I was trying to watch this film. So she was laying on the couch as I'm watching it. So she was floating in and out of consciousness, not completely watching all the time.
A terrible movie for that to happen.
Yes. The next morning she asked, it was about 45 minutes in, 50 minutes in. She's like, what's happening? And I just said, just go back to sleep. Just go to sleep, because it'll take too long.
Yeah.
she didn't really watch it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I think that's it.
All right. It has been a great episode of Zach on Film. Head over to MajorSpoilers.com. That should be up and running by the time.
Hopefully,
fingers crossed. You can comment on anything we've talked about or give your own thoughts and readings into Brazil on the podcast posting page. You can use our Amazon affiliate link to go do all of your holiday shopping. You can buy the Criterion version of Brazil. Hopefully my parents did. I asked them for it. That would be so kind of them. They don't listen to the podcast, so they're not going to hear this plea. But you can certainly buy that version of Brazil, or even, I'm going to guess, probably the Battle of Brazil book detailing
the fight
between Gilliam and the studio about that. It's not going to cost you any extra, but a little bit will come back to Major Spoilers to help keep the site afloat. Next week, it's the big one, the last one on the list, Citizen Kane on Zach on Film.